And by David and Lionel, who worked on Wilson loops in superspace, and so in this talk, I want to address some questions that I had, and also Simon addressed recently. But maybe the first one is sort of a geometrical question: how can we define null polygonal Wilson loops in the full n equals 4 superspace? Then I'm going to talk about how that relates to twisters, or what is a nice and suitable twister representation of that, which seems to be a very natural formulation for it. Just having the geometry is nice, but of course we always want to calculate something, and how can we calculate such loops in the full superspace? And in particular, I want to make use of the full supersymmetry, and therefore it's convenient to use a full n equals 4 superspace formulation. Sometimes something that people always would like to have but never use. And finally, if I have the time, maybe I can also comment on how the UV properties of the Wilson loop, how they violate superconformal and also the Jungian symmetries. But I can only sketch things, I guess. So I should say all of this really has, for the time being, nothing to do with scattering amplitudes. There may be a relation to scattering amplitudes, but in particular, if you're in full n equals 4 superspace, this relation is not so clear anymore. If you truncate to the chiral superspace, you probably can, or probably cannot, but I won't comment on it, related to scattering amplitudes. I will only focus on the one loop case, and of course, interesting things really start at two loops, but if you don't really know the one loop, then at two loops you don't see too much. But before I go super, I'll be a bit ordinary and maybe just remind you of a few facts for bosonic null polygonal Wilson loops. That will maybe prepare us to understand how to extend it to superspace and what the problems in that are. So the way I want to address these null polygonal Wilson loops in the full superspace is I always want to understand things in terms of symmetry, so it's good to understand how these Wilson loops will transform under superconformal transformations. And so let's just look at the ordinary bosonic Wilson loops. Null polygons and conformal transformations. So we have this some polygon where all the segments are light-like. The question is, how does that transform under conformal transformations? The answer is, although the conformal transformations are quite nonlinear, this will transform to some other polygon with the same number of segments, of course. But why is that so? How can such a nonlinear transformation map something linear to something linear? In fact, if you have a light-like curve, then under conformal transformations, that is, of course, preserved. So light-likeness is preserved. But But that's not, light-likeness is not the only property of the Wilson loop or of, the poly, of this polygon, but the other property is straightness. And, well, you might find various formulations of how to, I mean, what is straight? A line is straight, but so something that depends linearly on the well, on the parameter of this line of the curve, something that's linear in it is of course straight, but even something that doesn't depend linearly on the tau of the curve can be straight. So the property of straightness really should view as that the second derivative is proportional to the first derivative. So that would be a statement which is invariant under reparametrization of the curve. Unfortunately, so if you do conformal transformations and you act on a straight curve, then generically that's not straight. I mean, as you know, lines under conformal transformations are generically mapped to circles in Euclidean geometry. So that sounds a bit contradictory, but the point is that if you take these two together, so a null straight curve maps indeed to null straight curve, and that's why null polygons are preserved under conformal transformations. That by itself is quite remarkable, and we want to generalize this feature to the supersymmetric case, because that will allow us to have objects which are, or whose expectation values are invariant under conformal transformations, almost. So that much about conformal transformations. Another reason why this works has to do with momentum twisters. And let me just remind you how you get from such a polygon where you label the vertices as x1, x2, x3, x4, and so on. So what you first do is you introduce the differences, and these are light-like, so we can decompose it in terms of spinner helicity coordinates, lambda, and the momentum twisters are then introduced by saying. By saying, okay, mu k equals xk dot lambda k with proper contraction of the indices, and then you have a momentum twister wk, which is lambda k and mu k, and this guy transforms linearly under the the SU2,2 conformal group in four dimensions. And then using momentum twisters, there's a convenient way to express the final result, and in particular, at one loop level, generically, the result of your Wilson loop expectation value will contain dialogues and log squares of where the arguments are composed from certain four brackets WK, WL, WK, WN, which is sort of the epsilon tensor contracted with four of these. So obviously these objects are invariant under SU2,2, and right, and then certain combination of these will appear as the arguments. Fine. So that much as a review of the bosonic story. how much of this can we extend to superspace, and what will change? I mean, some things will not really work in superspace, or will have to be formulated differently. Okay. Towards superspace. Superspace has four bosonic coordinates, and then we have theta and theta bar. These are 8 and 8. These are complex, so we have 8 complex thetas, or 16 real thetas in 3,1 signature. I will mostly use 3,1 signature. I think everything can be formulated there. Okay. Now, what does light-like mean? There is a certain property of superspace which is related to the superalgebra, and in particular this relation, which implies some torsion of the superspace, and that complicates the matter quite a bit. But still, you can make sense of it. This torsion in particular means that if you look at the quantity x dot, so the tangent vector in the bosonic direction, that by itself is not stable under super Poincaré transformations, and therefore it's not very convenient to use it in our expressions. But there is a better expression, namely qualitatively. This is written as something like this. This combination for a curve is indeed invariant under supertranslations, and therefore it's a good thing to use, because we have a large part of our super conformal symmetry manifestly realized when we use this instead of x dot. And in particular, the light-like conditions can then be formulated using this e squared is 0. And of course, there are relations between e and the fermionic coordinates. This must be 0 and e. That must be 0. If a curve satisfies these conditions, it's light-like, or you can consider it light-like. And nicely, this condition is also these conditions, if you put them together, are invariant under superconformal transformations. So once you have a light-like curve, it's also light-like after superconformal transformations. In particular, well, there are few things follow from that. Also, this guy squared is 0. This guy squared is 0. And but just to show you what happens if I use x dot squared, then this is not 0, but it's some combination of theta, theta bar dot, and theta, theta bar, something like that. Okay, so that's just something you have to pay a bit of attention to. And if you have these equations, then you can solve them as before. You can say E use some spinner variables, because E is a 2x2 matrix, and then but with zero determinant, so you can decompose it again. And theta dot will be lambda eta, and theta bar dot will be eta bar lambda bar. Okay. So that's light-likeness. The other property that I want, of course, is straightness. And Well, for example, you could try x equals x naught plus tau delta x theta naught plus tau delta theta and theta. Just something that depends linearly on the curve parameter tau. The trouble with that is, well, if you apply a superconformal transformation that and you do it on paper, that keeps you busy for a few days, then you have to use all the kinds of spinner identities but you'll eventually see that that this is not straight under superconformal transformation. So you have a straight null curve. Even if it's null, you map it to something which is slightly curved, or is certainly not of that form. So that's the first thing. If you try it in a pedestrian way, it's a bit inconvenient. So how can you define this Wilson loop in full superspace? So maybe I can just tell you the answer. The answer to that problem is maybe not so straightforward, but what you should consider is the trajectory of a superparticle in this superspace. That sounds right because well your particle is massless, so a superparticle of n equals 4 super Young Mills, which is superconformal, should be stable under superconformal transformations. Now the trajectory of a superparticle you can write as follows. I guess this goes back to work of Witten in the 70s or 80s. Plus a few more terms. Theta is theta naught plus lambda sigma, and theta bar is theta naught bar plus sigma bar lambda bar. And here are a few more terms, including sigmas. Now, tau is a real parameter, and sigma bar is a two-dimensional complex number, but a Grassmann complex number. And you can see that, I mean, if you take these equations, you can see that this is indeed a null curve. It satisfies all these light-likeness conditions. There's no tau. There's no tau. And so altogether, this here defines a manifold. Oops. Sorry. Of course, this is four. So these are four sigmas are four component complex numbers. So these transform under SU4. So altogether, this is a submanifold. The trajectory of a superparticle is a submanifold of the full superspace, which is 3, 16. So it has one bosonic direction, as you would imagine for a for a trajectory of a particle. But in addition, it has 8 fermionic coordinates. So 8 out of the 16. So it's so you should. This is your full superspace. Then the trajectory is something like that. It's sort of a line, but it's somehow slightly elongated in the theta directions. It's fattened in the theta directions. So yeah. So it's a sort of fat line. Or it's just the trajectory of the superparticle. I guess in terms of physics, this probably relates to something like kappa symmetry. So your trajectory of a physically speaking, you should say that it doesn't really matter how the superparticle moves along this fat line. Everything should be physically equivalent. It's just that you have some gauge degree of freedom for choosing your actual. So of course you can always try to embed some line, some truly one-dimensional line in this trajectory of a superparticle. Whichever you choose doesn't matter. So you might say, okay, I want to choose a particular sigma which depends on tau, and that addresses Petrov's question. How does tau appear here? Well, it doesn't really appear, or if you wish, you could say sigma is a function of tau. And so, but the nice thing of about this is that it's stable under superconformal transformations, and to well, when you consider this before what I said before, sort of you start with a straight line in this submanifold, and it gets mapped to a line which is slightly curved, but still within the within the sub manifold. Yes. Yes, exactly. So Joe asked, what happens if I say this is linear and that's not plus tau. Certainly do. The question, the problem with that is that after the conformal transformation, in particular after superconformal boosts, it won't be linear. Right. So that's such a line is not invariant under superconformal transformations, but this object is. Okay, so what does it mean for our Wilson loop, and in particular how it transforms under superconformal transformations? Well, so a segment of the Wilson loop should really be, if you want nice superconformal properties, it should be the trajectory of a superparticle, and then you put these segments together to form a closed fat polygon. Okay, but of course, now you're interested in a Wilson loop, and the question is which path should you choose? Like straight lines or maybe some curved lines? Which is the right path for defining the Wilson loop? And for that, that question Witten already answered a few decades ago. So the R in the power 1/8 does not matter. And how do you see it? Well, there is a superspace field string F. So this F has, you know, it has the usual F mu nu coordinate. Okay, maybe I should start with the superspace connection. So you can define super Young Mills in n equals 4 superspace, and then you have a connection in all the directions of your superspace, including the fermionic ones. And so the field strength will have these components, F mu alpha dot, F alpha beta dot, F alpha dot beta dot. The point is, if you, this connection contains way too many degrees of freedom, and you need to restrict them. And the way to restrict them is to impose certain constraints on the field strength. And here you say it's, you essentially say this is proportional to this, to some scalars. This is proportional to the same scalars, and this part of the field strength is zero. And this imposes further constraints on those. The point is that this field strength as a two form pulled back to your trajectory of the superparticle. So on the fat null line is exactly zero. So the gauge, the curvature of the gauge field on a fat line is zero, and that means for the purposes of the Wilson loop, we can take any path. Any path is equivalent to any other path. Yeah, but I can make sense of quantum field theory only on shell. So everything I will be talking about is on shell. Right. Okay. So I mean, the way to see it is, let me just write down some component F alpha beta d theta alpha d theta beta. Now, we know that F alpha beta must be proportional to some gamma matrix times the scalars d theta alpha d theta beta. Now, these d thetas, as you see here, are d sigmas, and the lambda comes always for the right. So this goes like phi m gamma alpha beta m lambda alpha, well, lambda beta and some two sigmas. But the point is that this together is zero, and therefore the curvature vanishes. So we should, if you want to define a Wilson loop in superspace, you should actually think of these fat lines. And then you can choose any path on this fat trajectory, and that should always give you the same expectation value. Maybe some comments. Well, we have two segments, and each segment is a 1/8 dimensional manifold. Yes? I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question. Oh, sure. I mean, here I was just illustrating why it's zero. If you also have F alpha beta E eta and so on, and these would also be zero because this E is also proportional just to lambdas. So it always contracts away. It's always zero. So all components of the field strength on the null line are zero. So does that answer the question? Okay. So now we have two segments. We want that they meet in a point, right? So what is the intersection of two of these? Well, first of all, you have to make them intersect, but as soon as they intersect, they will meet in a true point that is R00. So there's no fermionic fuss or soul associated to this point. That's simply because the dimension of the full superspace is 16, and you remove 8 here from one line, you remove 8 from the other, and so fermionically there's zero. Should also say there is a unique fat line joining two points, two null separated points. So give you two vertices of the polygon, and you know what this fat line is. So therefore, the fat polygon is specified through a sequence of points x1, theta1, theta1 bar, x2, x3, x4. And as I said, the expectation value will not depend on which part you choose. Two more points, just a curious fact. So we measured the null condition using this E, which is something like x1 minus x2 plus theta1 theta2 bar minus theta2 theta1 bar. So E squared is null. But if you look at the delta x, which would be x1 minus x2 and so on, putting these segments together will close the Wilson loop. So E is null, but the delta x is closed. In particular, the E's, if you sum up all these E's around the polygon, that will not close. It's a bit curious in terms of if you want to relate it to scattering amplitudes. So then, P should it be E or should, I mean, the momentum, should it be E or should it be delta X? It's not so clear. I mean, you'd want it to be delta X because of momentum conservation. On the other hand, you want the particles to be light-like, so E squared or P squared is zero, which is E squared. And we've seen already there that delta X squared is not precisely zero. Okay. So far, are there further questions? Okay, now next topic will be twisters. Can we find a nice twister description of such polygons for these fat null polygons? So So in the bosonic case, we've seen that the momentum twisters are very useful. Here, it will be slightly different, maybe, also similar. So the starting point is that our polygon is described by a sequence of null separated points, xk, theta k, bar k in superspace. And the first step is to use spinoricity variables. Yes. If you can't see it in the first row, I shouldn't really do it. So spinner elicity. So you say xk plus one, xk plus one minus xk. And I should use these combinations with E. This combination, you just say, is lambda k bar. This is null, so I can write it in this fashion. Then theta k plus 1 minus theta k, I call lambda k theta k, and that's more or less what one does in the chiral superspace, so maybe except this where in the chiral superspace, you would discard the theta bars, and so this is the usual thing. But now we have the complex conjugate theta coordinates, and we call these eta bar lambda bar k. So that's sort of essentially the same complex conjugate. So we have our spinoricity coordinates have now four additional eta bars, which is also strange if you think about scattering amplitudes, but for Wilson loops, it's very natural. So then step two, you introduce twisters, much like in the bosonic case, to say mu k is lambda k dot xk plus chi k is lambda k dot theta k, and the conjugate ones, mu bar, is something like xk minus dot lambda bar k, and chi k is theta bar k dot lambda bar k, where maybe I should say x plus minus are these known chiral combinations of the coordinates, that's x plus minus theta bar. Right, so in some sense, we've introduced one super twister here and combined this into a WK, which consists of the lambda K, mu K, and chi K. So that's what you get for momentum twisters for the chiral case. But you also have the complex conjugate one, which is lambda bar k, u bar k, and chi bar k. Right. So this is Hodge's momentum twister. This is simply the conjugate. That is to say, in 3.1 signature, it's actually properly the conjugate. And these fellows transform under well, PSU 2.2/4, and also as PSU. So these are projective fundamental representations of PSU 2.2/4, and these are the conjugate ones. So they transform linearly under conformal transformations. Right.
I'm not sure what you mean by PSU 2.2, but what you probably mean is just projective representations.
Yes.
But the group, there's no such group as PSU 2.2. It's the same as SU 2.2 because the determinant is one.
It's a different group. But it doesn't matter. I mean, /4, right? /4. Yeah, I mean, the representation here is projective. Yes. That's all I need. You can put as many P's and S's as you wish, or not. Right. So one nice feature about the momentum twisters is that these provide variables for your to describe your polygon in an unconstrained fashion. So you can invent any W's you like, and they will describe a null polygon. However, that only really works in split or complex signature. Here we have not just the W's, but also their conjugates, and they satisfy some constraints. So WK's, W bar, K's are constrained. And really, you cannot get around it. If you're interested in a real Minkowskian signature, variables are constrained. You really, that's a fact of life, no matter how you twist it. But the constraints here is that you can show, if you introduce those new variables, you can show that that WK dot WK bar is 0 and WK dot WK bar plus minus 1 is 0. This essentially follows from the definition of X plus minus, which is X plus minus theta theta bar, and then you can say X plus minus X minus is 2 theta theta bar. And this really means that you get some constraints like these. This condition is known for twister people, or in some way this is known as an ambi-twister. Although I've learned yesterday that maybe there's an issue about the complex reality conditions, but generically such a condition between two complex or two conjugate twisters is known as an, and when that vanishes, it's known as an ambi-twister. And this is something which this is an additional condition. If you have a set of ambi-twisters, then two consecutive ones for the description of the polygon, they should be zero, and you might call this whole thing momentum ambitwisters. Just maybe to count the degrees of freedom, we have all these coordinates, x, theta, theta bar. And we have n vertices, and I'm writing too small, I know. These are 4n coordinates, and these are 16n, but then the light likeness condition removes one bosonic and eight fermionic coordinates. So the degrees of freedom to describe your Wilson loop are 3n/8n in the original description. Now, the ambitwisters, momentum ambitwisters, give you precisely as many. So the WKs have 4n/4n, but we want to consider projective ones. So this is, you remove one bosonic degree of freedom from them. The same for W bar. So you have 4n/4n, and they are projective independently. So you also remove one here. So you have 6n. / 8n, but then you have these constraints. This is 1 kk, kk plus 1 and kk minus 1, so minus 3n. So in total we have 3n/8n degrees of freedom. So a set of twisters which satisfy this ambi and this momentum twister condition, they describe you a null polygon in full superspace. So maybe this is sort of just done at the level of formulas, but you can also understand it in terms of geometry. Such an ambi twister consisting of a W and a conjugate one, sometimes called VK, with the condition WK dot bar K is zero. This you can really understand in terms of, well, what these twisters describe. So a usual twister gives you an equation, well, gives you a submanifold through equations lambda K dot X equals UK and X plus and lambda dot theta equals chi k. So this gives you so your full superspace is 4/16. These are 2 0 constraints. These are 0 4. So these are 2/12. So a twister describes a two-dimensional, totally null surface and with 12 fermionic coordinates. For the conjugate one, you sort of have the same x minus dot lambda bar k is mu bar k, and theta bar lambda bar k is I bar k, and that again is 2/12. Generically, these two submanifolds of superspace don't intersect, but But they do intersect if you impose this condition. This just ensures that they intersect. And and then putting these things together gives you a 1/8 dimensional manifold null. So this is ambitwister describes null, well, the trajectory of a superparticle or our pad line. So that means you're when you take a polygon, then this is these twisters WW bar describe the segments of the polygon. I mean, it's nothing different, much different from the bosonic case. It's just that here you, for the full superspace, you have both the, you naturally have both the twister and its complex conjugate, and so on. Now, furthermore, you have these conditions, WK dot WK plus or minus 1 equals 0, and they simply ensure that this line, they do intersect in a point. If you don't have this condition, then these would be sort of lines which don't meet at all. But for Wilson loop, you want them to meet, and so that's the condition that the segments intersect. Then I would like to use the remaining time for the calculation of the Wilson loop, or just sketch some steps of it. Compute. So we have the Wilson loop in the n equals four superspace, but we don't really have an n equals four manifest description of n equals four super Young Mills. However, here. For manifest. But here, as a first step, I want to restrict to one loop. And for one loop, the only thing in Wilson loops we need is a propagator between two segments. And so we might as well use the abelian version. And that's, of course, well, a nice simplification. Okay. So let me try to compute this expectation value in superspace. So our connection, superspace connection, is the usual bosonic connection, A dx. Maybe I should use E here. Plus the fermionic, so it's dx plus something else, plus the fermionic parts of the connection contracted to d theta plus a f bar d theta bar. And we have constraints on f, which is, in the abelian theory, just the D of A. Then you can solve most of these constraints if you introduce a prepotential. You say A is dB, or A fermionic, A fermionic bar, D bar, B bar, and AB is something like dA plus dA bar plus D bar A. So B is free potential. And now I want to solve these constraints. That is, if I solve the constraints, I solve the equations of motion. So I want to find a mode expansion for our field B, A, or the field strength. And when I have the mode expansion of the field, then I can use canonical quantization. People will like me here very much if I do that. So the solution for this field B, I can just sketch. So I will. Yes, thanks. No, actually, I think I want to have the A. Yes. So it's quite, I mean, just on dimensional grounds, this should be the fermionic derivative of a fermionic component that is part of the curvature condition. So what I know about this theory is that, well, we have 16 types of particles, and these are on shell. So what I can do is I can say B, what you should do is the usual quantum field theory mode expansion, that's something like D3P over 2E. But as we know, as we like spinners and twisters, this is probably easier to use spinner variables. So these parameters has an on-shell momentum. Then Fourier factor e to the I lambda x plus lambda bar. And, well, then I put some field C, depends on this lambda, lambda bar, and lambda dot theta. And these are, if you like, these are the light cone degrees of freedom. The light cone is specified through, the direction of the light cone is specified through lambda, and lambda dot theta, these are four Grassmann. This has four Grassmann dependence on four Grassmann variables. So it means you have 2 to the 4 that is 16 degrees of freedom for each momentum, and that's precisely what we want. So you can do the same thing with B bar. You get essentially the complex conjugate of that. And so that tells us what a generic plane wave solution for our field is. And then what we do is canonical quantization, and really the obvious thing for a correlator would be C of lambda, lambda bar, and chi with C of lambda prime, lambda bar prime, chi prime. Well, what can you write down? Well, first of all, you want this, you want to preserve momentum, so this should be delta squared, delta 2 of lambda minus lambda prime, delta 2, lambda bar. Let me put a plus here, lambda bar prime, and delta 4. chi minus chi prime. And there's some some other stuff in there which is needed for nice projective weights, but let me skip that. So I mean, this is really the natural thing, and probably quite surely the only thing you can write down if you want to preserve conformal invariants. And so once you're there, we have a field-field correlator. We have the definition of the Wilson loop, and because we have a connection. And so now calculate. So the Wilson loop expectation value will be, you know, given in terms of these things. Where you have two gauge fields sitting at the two opposing segments, and here we can express the gauge field through the prepotential and through the on-shell, through the mode expansion, and so there will be there are three contributions. There's contribution from CC plus C, C bar, plus C bar, C bar. And I should have said, well, okay, there's C, and there's the complex conjugate C in the B bar, and there is a relation. So C bar is C, sort of the Fourier transform, D4 chi, e to the chi chi bar of C chi. So once we know C bar, and so we can substitute this in here. So we have everything we need for the calculation. Let me just sketch what these three things, they all give different types of contributions. This gives the level NMHV R factor. This gives the one loop MHV contribution. And for scattering amplitudes, this really doesn't make sense, but if you wish, it's just the conjugate of this, and this is some sort of three level NMHV bar. So I have some various comments on it. Maybe just in terms of the calculation, when you perform this calculation, so compute. And let me just stick to this part, to the one loop MHV. You perform all the integrals, you quite easily get to something which is Li2 of WK minus 1 dot W bar J minus 1 WK WK by J. Terms like these and pardon? No, this is all proper 3.1 signature. Yes. Yeah, this is D4 lambda, and this is, you can all properly define it in real signature. So you compute this thing, you find a dialogue, which is what you expect, and the argument is some cross ratio. And in fact, I mean, you see all the projective weights are zero for this expression. So it's a conformal cross ratio. It's fully conformal invariant. So this is nice. And if you put things together, you certainly get most of the one loop MHV expression that we know quite well. But it now includes this thing, of course, includes all the fermionic degrees of freedom. So it's a full supersymmetric, superconformal expression. But there's, of course, if you're at one loop, you run into trouble, which are the UV divergences. And this has to do, you see, when you have two generic segments, there's all of these things are properly defined. But as soon as these segments sort of come too close to each other, then say if this is segment K and this is segment J and they are joined by just a single segment, then probably this term here is actually something like WJ plus 1 WJ bar, and this is zero, and then all of a sudden you have zeros or infinities as arguments of logs and dialogues, and then the expression diverges. So you have to regularize this somehow. You can try to heuristically do it, but there's also a proper way to do it. Is sort of, you don't compute the correlator of this Wilson loop, or the expectation value of this Wilson loop, but sort of take two Wilson loops which are almost the same, and then you take the correlator between the two Wilson loops, and that will regularize the singularities, and then you can move the two Wilson loops onto each other and see what you get. This is some sort of, if you wish, some sort of point splitting or framing regularization. So then you also know how to compute all the terms, even if the segments are near to each other. And depending on how you do it, I mean, of course, if you do this type of regularization, then it still depends on how you move these two slightly different Wilson loops onto each other. This has many degrees of freedom, and so the result will largely depend on how you do this, and that's sort of the dependence on the regularization that you still get in the divergent or due to the divergent terms. In fact, we found a good expression. Found two types of expressions. Yes? Pardon? I am over time?
Yes.
Okay. I will not use too much more time. I'm just summarizing where we stand at the moment. So we have two useful expressions for the Wilson loop expectation value at one loop. One preserves n equals 4 super Poincaré manifestly, but it does. I mean, all these things are properly super conformal invariant quantities. But once you do the regularization, you somehow have to break some symmetries. You can make it such that n equals 4 super Poincaré is preserved, and that you sort of do by you use some of these spinner brackets, JK, and those preserve super Poincaré, but they don't preserve super conformal. So by introducing a few of these, you can find a nice expression. But you can also have one which preserves super conformal up to the reference twister. W star, if you wish, and then you get expressions which are like W K A dot W star. These, of course, also break superconformal invariance because you would transform only these, but not those. So there are various ways of regularizing the result. And the final thing is maybe if you sort of convert this back to the original coordinates, what do you get? Or how does this compare to the Wilson loop in to the chiral Wilson loop? So what I want to draw here is so remember we had a way to express our polygon in terms of lambda, lambda bar, eta, and eta bar. This is somehow very close to scattering amplitudes where you would use these three variables. But now we have the eta bars. Let me just sort of show the expression will be some polynomial in eta k, eta bar j. If you expand out the Grassmann variables and so on. So the one loop result actually has three types of components. There's essentially it's these. So this comes for the one loop MHV, and it has all these higher powers in eta bar eta. So these are all eta bar eta to the K contributions. It's sort of leveled out, and that's why it's an NMHV contribution. This here is the ordinary bosonic part of the result. Now, here you have four more etas than eta bars, so and you, in particular, you don't have eta. So this is eta to the 4, eta bar to the 0. So this is clearly an MHV tree level. And as far as I can tell, I think it's just this contribution. It doesn't have all this tail. And say this is some sort of an MHV bar thing, which is conjugate, but sort of new. You might wonder what all these things, what's their purpose in life. Well, and that's sort of the thing that Simon considered. So he was doing a two-loop calculation, and he tried to sort of get this value at two loops. But instead, he considered this value, which somehow relates to the supersymmetry variation of the original result. So sort of, if you do super conformal supersymmetry transformations, you sort of add or remove thetas by super transformations or super boosts, somehow change the number of eta and eta bars, and so sort of you move from this place to another place, and because the amplitude doesn't contain anything here, and it's easy to sort of go from here to there, and there's nothing to compensate. But what he sort of did is said that if you do a super conformal transformation on the full result, then, well, you should get zero. It's sort of the result should be invariant under super conformal transformations. Now, sort of going from here, you do the transformation, you find two contributions at this point. One comes from here, and one comes from there. And so what he computed this part of the result and used the supersymmetry variation to recover this part of the result, which is more complicated. So in that sense, what these additional terms in our calculation mean is that they correspond to the breakdown of superconformal symmetries of the bosonic, the purely bosonic NMHV result, one loop MHV result. And anyway, as time has proceeded, I should stop.
Given time, I propose that we postpone questions for the coffee break, which will last for 20 minutes, meaning that we start at 11:35.